Today, I'll talk with Sue Savage-Rumbaugh, resident scientist at the Iowa Primate Learning Sanctuary in Des Moines, formerly known as the Great Ape Trust. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Iowa Primate Learning Sanctuary is home to six bonobos, the most famous of whom is Kanzi, a 32-year-old bonobo who communicates with humans through lexigrams or symbols. In September, Sue Savage-Rumbaugh was placed on leave because of accusations filed by former employees. She has been cleared in an investigation and has now returned as the resident scientist. I'll talk with her and Julie Gilmore, the new director of the sanctuary, about the work being done there and plans for the future. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Good morning. Later this hour, we're going to meet Brittany Griffith, a professional rock climber from Iowa. She graduated from Ames High School and earned a communications degree from the University of Iowa before going on to become a professional rock climber. She's now 43 years old and makes her living traveling around the world, doing amazing climbs. We'll talk about her adventures later this hour. But first, the Iowa Primate Learning Sanctuary in Des Moines, formerly known as the Great Ape Trust, has been making a lot of news lately. The sanctuary is home to six bonobos living in a unique human bonobo family and culture. Some of the bonobos, including Kanzi, who's a 32-year-old bonobo, communicate with humans using lexigrams or symbols and even seem to understand human speech. This June, we visited the Great Ape Trust and brought you a long feature in September about our visit there. But there has been controversy. In September, a group of former employees made public accusations that Sue Savage-Rumbaugh, senior scientist at the sanctuary, was mentally unfit to continue her work, and they claimed she was putting the bonobos in her care at risk. Savage-Rumbaugh has been cleared in an investigation and reinstated as resident scientist, but there has been other bad news as well. Pan Benicia, a 27-year-old bonobo with advanced communication skills, recently died of pneumonia earlier this month. Now, Savage-Rumbaugh is back at work, and a new director, veterinarian Julie Gilmore, has been named. They are both here with me today. Sue, thank you so much for being back on the show with us today.
Well, thank you for asking me.
And Julie Gilmore, welcome.
And thank you. We're happy to be here.
We do have some topics today that are off limits due to pending litigation, but we are going to talk about the work you're doing at the sanctuary and plans for the future. And Sue, I want to start with you. For people who didn't hear the Talk of Iowa that came out of our visit with you in June, let's give a little bit of background about what you're doing. You have been involved in this work for more than three decades, although you haven't been in Iowa nearly that long. But give us a little bit of an overview of the type of culture that you've tried to create.
Well, the question started with whether or not apes could learn language. And initially, an ape was put in kind of a Skinner box, Lana, and Dwayne Rumbaugh tried to teach her by a machine, but it turned out that humans had to be involved. And we as scientists began to learn the importance of dialogue, and then we began to learn the importance of rearing and began to learn the importance of culture. Because language in a human child is something that appears spontaneously, but it's surrounded by a family and a culture and a village. And so if you want to ask that question about the most closely related species on the planet, you have to give them some of those things too. Otherwise, it's not a fair question. So that's what we're about here.
And as I mentioned, you've been engaged in this work for more than three decades, and your partner in this work, one of your primary partners in this work, is Kanzi, who is 32 years old. Tell us about Kanzi.
Well, Kanzi's name means buried treasure, and he certainly was a buried treasure because Kanzi broke the paradigm. Before that, we thought that children with retardation and children with autism and apes and any being that didn't speak language spontaneously had to be taught by rote methods where things were practiced over and over. Kanzi was a treasure because we were trying to teach his mother using those same old time-worn rote methods. And Kanzi was just playing around as a little kid, and suddenly he was learning all the things that we were trying to teach his mother. So Kanzi really taught us that we as scientists didn't know as much as we thought we knew, and that rather than practice and trials, what we need to be attending to was the sociocultural environment that we were creating around him. Kanzi is now, as you say, in his 30s. He's a magnificent-looking male. When I began, I thought maybe they could learn a few words and maybe make some simple sentences. Kanzi's gone much beyond that. Kanzi is a true being of intellect and intelligence. He can understand much of what's said to him. I think of him as another form of human. I seek his advice. I counsel with him. I negotiate with him. I treat him in every way as a living, sentient, intellectually competent being who has a right to make his own decisions, a right to his own thoughts, a right to his own wishes and desires. And therefore, it is important to build a kind of a world for Kanzi and the other bonobos that can encompass beings that were far more sentient and intelligent than I ever thought could be possible when I began.
You also have a very young bonobo in your care, Tico, who is a two-year-old. Or is he still two?
Yeah, he was two in June, so okay. He won't be three till next June.
All right. And he is growing up in this culture. What do you think we can learn from Tico, who is really the only creature to ever grow up from the very start in this kind of environment?
Well, Kanzi is Tico's dad, and Alikia is Tico's bonobo mother, and they both work at teaching him things all of the time. Tico is a third-generation captive bonobo, a third-generation bonobo with exposure to human culture, and he is very different. He is showing many, many more human-like patterns than Kanzi himself showed at 2 years of age. So what we're seeing is kind of evolution on fast forward. Tico teaches us what the seeds of human culture do when they are impregnated into a species very, very similar to our own. And he teaches us what could have happened to humanity itself many millions of years ago.
Well, and we should mention that although Kanzi is Tico's dad and Alikia is Tico's mom, Tico nearly died as an infant and has really been primarily in your care and in your sister's care.
Well, Tico was in Alikia's care for the first 2 months of his life. He nearly died when he was born because he didn't breathe for 3 hours. But when he did first breathe, it was a lusty breath, and he made a vocalization that was heard throughout the lab. But unlike all of the other bonobos, Tico was born without the tendency to cling with his feet. And when you're a quadrupedal mother walking about the cage, you need the baby to hold on with its feet. The heavier it gets, the harder it becomes for you to move around the cage. If you're bipedal, as a human is, you can stand up and you can use your hands to carry the baby, as we all do, unless we invent a little backpack or something to put the baby in. So Alikia had trouble carrying the baby, and she was asking both Liz and myself to stay with her constantly, and also Pan Benicia and help take care of the baby, and Matata to help take care of the baby. And she was putting the baby down a lot because it was simply difficult to carry Tico. So we have continued to help Alikia with the rearing of Tico. Alikia watches over Tico day and night, and Tico can go in and out with Alikia. He can go in and out with Kanzi. He can go in and out with any of the other bonobos. Basically, we have an extended bonobo-human family. They consider us family members. We consider them family members. We love each other. We share our lives together. And so for them, It's not like somebody took Tico. It's like somebody helped Alikia with Tico.
Can you give me an example? Kanzi was about Tico's age when you first started working with him with lexicrams and he began acquiring language. Can you give me an example of something that Tico can do that maybe Kanzi couldn't have done at that age?
Tico is constantly handing people objects and wanting to share over and over and over. Mm-hmm. Every little bit that he eats, every toy that he has, he throws balls back and forth constantly. At about 2 years of age, human children do the same kind of, I'm showing you this, I'm showing you that. What do you do with this? What do you do with that? And Tico, I won't say that Kanzi didn't do that, but he certainly didn't do it with the intensity and frequency and reflective capacity that Tico has at this time.
When you first came to Iowa and became a part of the Great Ape Trust, there was a benefactor who founded the Great Ape Trust, Ted Townsend, and you were extremely well-funded for many years. And this is a privilege that many people who, like yourself, have worked in academia don't get to experience. However, that funding has disappeared, and when we came to visit you in June, you were at something of a crossroads where you were looking for a different future, a new future for your organization, a future that would enable you to keep the bonobos together and continue your research, but also would enable you to have enough money to get by. And it seemed to me a real time of crisis. Of course, as I mentioned in the introduction, there have been a few more crises that have come since that point. But how are you keeping things going on a day-to-day basis at the sanctuary now?
Well, first of all, let me say I always have been and remain extremely grateful for everything that Ted Townsend did. I think that maybe Mr. Townsend was ahead of his time in bringing us here. And it's been a new and sometimes difficult message to get across about the kind of research that we're doing and how we would become open to the public, how we would allow the bonobos to interact with the public, to communicate with the public, was something that was a conversation across many years and in many meetings. We have never wanted to be a zoo. If anything, we want to be an unzoo or a non-zoo. So we are aiming at this now, and we are close, we believe, to getting our exhibitor's license, which will allow us to have the public in. One of my main goals in doing that is to allow the bonobos and the public to actually interact. There are many things that you can write in a book. There are even things you can show on videotape. But the life-changing experiences happen when you and a member of a different species make intelligent eye-to-eye contact, mind-to-mind contact, brain-to-brain contact. Sometimes it's with a gesture, sometimes it's with a lexicogram. Sometimes it's a moment of recognition that they really understood exactly what you said. But there's not been anyone that's ever visited the facility that has had interaction with the bonobos that has not walked away changed. And that's what I want to give other Iowans an opportunity to do.
I'm talking with Sue Savage Rumbaugh. She is the resident scientist as what is now being called the Iowa Primate Learning Sanctuary, formerly the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines. We have to take a short break. Also with me, veterinarian Julie Gilmore, who is now the new director of the sanctuary. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm visiting right now with Sue Savage Rumbaugh, who's the resident scientist at the Iowa Primate Learning Sanctuary in Des Moines, formerly known as the Great Ape Trust. She has recently been reinstated in her position at the sanctuary following an investigation. Julie Gilmore is also with me. She has been the veterinarian at the sanctuary, and she has now been named director of the Iowa Primate Learning Sanctuary in Des Moines. And we need to talk about the future of the sanctuary. As I mentioned, finances have been a real issue following the expiration of the funding from Ted Townsend, who brought the Great Ape Trust to Iowa, created the Great Ape Trust in Iowa. And you and your board of directors, you've been searching for ways to make this sanctuary a financially viable concern. Julie, as you take over and come on board, what does the financial outlook of the sanctuary look like?
Well, fundraising continues to be a top priority at IPLS. We are in the process now. Actually, we have a couple of grant applications out that are pending, and we continue to brainstorm as a group as a way to keep this resource viable and accessible for Iowans. And so that's definitely an ongoing issue and something that we are addressing day to day.
What's it going to take to make it viable?
Well, one of our, again, in addition to the grants that are pending that hopefully will come in and help us continue to develop the facility in a way that will kind of progress Dr. Savage Rumbaugh's vision of creating this cultural, cross-cultural learning environment for bonobos and humans alike. We are continuing to, focus on that as an educational endeavor for the public. And so we're really excited the potential of bringing the public in. We think that not only will that help with funding, but obviously day-to-day, gated mission fees and things like that will help us continue to create a successful and viable entity there.
I want to ask you about the death of Panbenisha. I know this is a very difficult subject to talk about, but as the veterinarian at the sanctuary, what happened?
Well, as we've reported in our press release and things like that earlier, this month, all of the bonobos there came down with a respiratory illness. Tico was actually the first infected with that. But as Sue mentioned, because the bonobos are so interchangeable and obviously are together as a group, everybody was exposed at more or less the same time. And so, unfortunately, that illness spread throughout the population of bonobos there. And Panbenisha was actually the fourth bonobo who was infected with that illness and was initially responding very much like the others had. With, just runny nose and cold and cough and just being a little depressed and things like that. But she progressed into something called acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS, which is we don't always understand what triggers that in some animals and not others, but she just developed a very difficult time breathing. We were with her moment by moment throughout that, trying to provide life-saving treatments like nebulization and oxygen therapy in addition to the number of medications she was on to make her more comfortable and to try to help her pull through that. And she just did not. She went into respiratory distress on the evening of November 6th, I think it was. And we, were there with her and tried to make a heroic effort to keep her with us. And it was just not to be.
Sue, the community of bonobos, as you mentioned, is very close. Although they're not always in physical contact with each other, the building is such that they can hear each other all the time. And it was very clear when I was there that the bonobos, at least who have language, communicate with each other, follow along at what's going on. And I can only assume that they also communicate with the bonobos who don't have human language. But how have the other bonobos reacted to Panbenisha's death?
Well, Panbenisha's absence has left a giant hole in the group, and we are all working to go forward. The thing we must avoid is all focusing on that hole. We have to all pull together and realize there is a future. I can tell you that Maisha, Panbenisha's mother, as soon as I went in with her after Panbenisha's death, grabbed me and hugged me and hugged me and hugged me and hugged me. She didn't let me go for maybe 20 or 30 minutes, and she put her head right on my breast, and then she wanted me to put my head on her breast and just held me, and you could see tears in her eyes, and you could also see tears in the eyes of Maisha, her son, who was, I guess, kind of Panbenisha's favorite male at that point in time. And Panbenisha sort of had the role of keeping young Maisha in line, because he tried to boss everybody around in the group, and Panbenisha kind of kept him in line. And he loved Panbenisha very much. And Inyota and Kanzi and Alikia were very depressed and sad and silent, as were many of the staff, and certainly my sister Liz and Liz's daughter Heather, who grew up with Pam and Nisha. It was a tragic loss. Pam and Nisha was, in a way, everything. She was mother, sister, daughter. She was, of all the bonobos, she had crossed the line into humanness far more than any other. And although I didn't ever take her out into the human world, it certainly would have been possible for her to enter the human world without attacking people. She understood her role as a bonobo. She understood that she was different. Pan Manisha often watched television shows about people contemplating their relationships to apes. She spent a lot of time studying what people thought about apes by watching it on television. And you could ask her deep questions about the topic. Saying such things goes far beyond the science that I've done to date. It is the kind of science I hope to be able to do in the future. But in my life, Pam and Nisha was a being of the first order. She was an inspiration to me. She was far more than what we would call a bonobo. She was a very, very special being on the planet. And I can only say that now I feel her around everywhere. Somehow she's here. She is everywhere.
You mentioned your sister Liz Rupert Pugh, who has worked with you for 3 decades and worked with Pan Benicia. And when I talked to her this summer, she talked about how Pan Benicia was really like another daughter to her. She's been with her entire life. And she said that she felt like Pan Benicia actually had even more language than Kanzi.
It was always said that Pam and Nisha was the true genius of the bonobos. Pam and Nisha was, and still is, a real presence. I can't think of anything that I could say to Pam and Nisha that she could not understand. There are some things that oftentimes I feel the other bonobos might or might not understand. That didn't happen with Pam and Nisha.
Julie, as a vet, one of the accounts that I read of Pam Benicia's death described her as a young bonobo. She was 27 years old. Can you put that in perspective for us?
Sure. Well, there are not many bonobos in captivity in North America, and so there's a small sample population from which to draw some of those figures. But what I will say is that she was certainly, we wouldn't consider her young. We would consider her more middle-aged at 27. There are not many bonobos who are in captivity who are, you know, in their 40s and 50s. And so our oldest bonobo, Matata, is the matriarch, and she's 43. And that puts her as one of the older bonobos that's in captivity in North America here. And unfortunately, this respiratory disease is a leading cause of death in the species. They're very susceptible to all of the same kind of organisms that we are as humans. And so 30 to 40% of the deaths in the species are similar. And so it was not an uncommon scenario, even though it was very tragic.
Sue, when I visited your organization in June, and I talked to Ken Schweller, the director of the board at the time, and we talked about the future of the sanctuary. And one of his hopes, and I believe yours as well, was to open to the public and to possibly bring in classes of students and to have an educational opportunity for people in Iowa, particularly for young people in Iowa. Recently, I've been reading about new plans that you have for the sanctuary, among them to create an artist colony and an opportunity for artists to visit the sanctuary. Can you tell me about that plan?
Well, I can tell you that this was part of the original reason for moving here, so that artists and musicians and general people from Iowa could interact with the bonobos. And we originally were going to have venues for rock napping, venues for painting, venues for sculpture, venues for basket making, all the kinds of things that humans and bonobos might share together through a glass wall in a little rounded area where you would travel to the rounded dome, both traveling on the outside on safe trails and then get into the little dome. And humans would have their sculpting things on one side and bonobos would have theirs on the other side. So while this may be new in the sense that we haven't talked about it publicly, it was part of the original design and is in all of the plans that were crafted and drawn up by architects in 2000 and then again in 2004 and even as late as 2008. We have not had the money to build out the land to that extent. We do hope to be able to do that in the future. The idea, I think, first came when Peter Gabriel came and spent a number of weeks on three different occasions in the lab and began to try to play music with Paminacea. We found the same thing that we had found with language and with tool manufacture. When you have someone who is really good at that particular activity and they start to link into a dialogue, a tool-making dialogue, a language dialogue, a musical dialogue with the bonobos, something unusual happens. And certainly Peter Gabriel was able to create music with Paminacea in a way that I could not and in a way that I had no idea she could do. So, yes, we want to bring together the paradigms of art and science. We want to have not just tests, can they do X, can they do Z? We want to provide conditions that will actually facilitate them showing us their view of art, their view of music, their view of sculpture, their view of storytelling.
In a grant application that you've filed in hopes of creating this kind of artist colony, the application notes that the program would be run by nationally known artist Russ Rupert of Springfield, Missouri, and that's your brother, right?
I'm very fortunate to have Russ Rupert as my brother. Yes, he's been president of the Sculpture Association of America, and he's one of the leading artists today in the field of stainless steel sculpture and neon sculpture.
That would, as I mentioned, your sister has been working with you for many decades. That would continue to make this, in many ways, a family affair.
Oh, it's certainly a family affair. My son was raised around Kanzi, and Heather was raised around Paminacea.
Your niece, right?
My niece, yes. It's definitely a family affair.
As you look to the future, and you're hoping, of course, for these grant applications to come through, what's the contingency plan? What if that doesn't happen?
Well, we're going to seek foundation grants in addition to the ones we have. It's only very recently we've put those forward. In order to put grants forward and to bring the public in, you must have an exhibitor's license. And as the facility was turned over to me, the previous exhibitor's license was canceled. The USDA agent who was new and who has extensive experience with apes of many different varieties, visited the facility and found that many things, in spite of the amount of money that Ted was contributing, were not really up to snuff. And a lot has needed to be done. And with the help of Dr. Gilmore and many others, we've brought the facility, in terms of procedures, protocols, and actual changes in the facility, caging, fencing, all kinds of areas, is now up to snuff. So now we are able to be open to the public. And, of course, many grants that one might apply for, whether it's the Art Place grant that we're currently applying for or the Prairie Meadows grant or others that we would apply for in Iowa, need you to have some kind of contact with the public. And before, we've always been kind of this elusive, secretive research institute, which neither Ted nor myself ever intended. So we've had to put in place, and rightfully so, all of the things that needed to be done to have our exhibitor's license. And Julie and I and members of the board now believe that we are well positioned to apply for grants here in Iowa, grants beyond Iowa, as we're doing, scientific grants as we develop colleagueship with other scientists, and also a funding stream from the educational programs we will have for the public. This was always Ted Townsend's intent. It just never happened that way, probably because Ted had enough money to keep it funded for the years between 2004 and 2011. But it was Ted's goal, and one of his goals, I think, in pulling out was to simply say to the community, look, my intent was never to fund this forever. It was to bring it to Iowa and let this happen. And so now is the time. Now is the time for it to happen, and it will happen.
So it sounds like you're not willing to have a backup plan at this point.
Well, no. You mean a backup plan of moving the bonobos?
Right.
No, that's not going to happen. This is a world-renowned research facility. There is no place else in the world that any apes do the kinds of things they do here. This kind of evolutionary science has never been done before. There is absolutely no reason that it can't be funded and not to continue it. Absolutely no reason that we will not succeed.
Sue, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome.
Sue Savage-Rumbaugh is the resident scientist at the Iowa Primate Learning Sanctuary in Des Moines. And Julie Gilmore, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Julie Gilmore is a veterinarian, but she's also now the new director of the Iowa Primate Learning Sanctuary, formerly the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines. Coming up in just a moment, we'll meet Brittany Griffith, a professional rock climber from Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When Brittany Griffith graduated from Ames High or was enjoying the sorority life at the University of Iowa, where she earned a communications degree, no one, not even Griffith, could have guessed what the future held for her. She's now a professional rock climber, one of the top names in the profession. Her home base is Salt Lake City, but she spends most of her time traveling the world. She's on the line with us today. Hello, Brittany.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
And sure.
Honestly, before I started reading about you, I didn't know that professional rock climber was a profession. So let's start with that.
I didn't either. When I started, I didn't either.
What is a professional rock climber?
Well, the way I, there's a couple different ways, professional climbers make a living. Some is off prize money that they make in competitions. I was never involved in competition climbing, so I found a way to be a resource for the different companies that manufacture climbing gear, and I help develop and test product. I work at grassroots events for them. I get marketing material for them, write for them, just basically a resource that's out in the field all the time that they can use for information and to represent the brand.
All right, and we can explore that relationship a little bit more, but tell me, when did you first start climbing?
I first started climbing in 1994. I climbed one day in Iowa. At the University of Iowa, you could take a gym class. You could get one gym credit. And we went up to Devil's Lake in Wisconsin, and that was the first time I ever put a harness on. And yeah,
before that, were you an outdoorsy person? Did you go camping, hiking, that kind of thing?
You know, I did all the kind of Midwest sports. I was always really active in track and field and basketball, softball. My mother took us camping and on a couple canoe trips when we were really young. But, basically from, I would say, early junior high on, I wasn't that outdoorsy. I was in the gym.
So this passion really got ignited on a road trip that you took with a boyfriend after college. Tell me about that.
Yeah, was living in Iowa City. I'd already graduated, and I was dating a guy who I was really into, and he asked me if I wanted to go on a road trip, and I asked what a road trip was, and naively, and he explained it's when you traveled around rock climbing. And, you know, I was really eager to explore different areas of the country outside of Iowa, and so that sounded like a great idea. It was more about traveling and getting outside the Midwest. I hadn't really traveled outside the Midwest, and the rock climbing was kind of secondary. But then, yeah, once I tried it, I was totally hooked. So,
tell me about a couple of those first experiences.
Oh, the first day was we drove across Iowa, Nebraska, ended up in Wyoming at this kind of notorious area called Bidavu, and it's trad climbing, which involves putting the gear in. It's kind of the more traditional way of climbing, and you know, you protect the cracks with your own gear. There was multi-pitch climbing, which got us off the ground quite a ways, a lot different than what I think most people are experiencing as their first time climbing now, which is in a climbing gym. You know, and I loved being off the ground. I loved the excitement of it, the adrenaline, the simplicity of it all, everything about it I was immediately enamored with.
After those first experiences, how did you pursue the sport?
I know in my heart I realized that this was kind of the first thing that ever made sense to me, really, which sounds kind of strange. But, you know, the living outside, the traveling part, the being in nature, you know, that was what I was really hooked on. And I decided that's the lifestyle that I wanted. And I didn't really care how I supported it. You know, I wasn't looking for a career in anything. It consumed me. And so, you know, I pretty much figured out right away how much money I needed for a tank of gas or how much money I needed for food. And I would just, you know, I lived on $300 a month doing whatever, mowing lawns, painting houses, babysitting, all kinds of random stuff.
And you basically lived out of a truck, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've lived in multiple vehicles. I lived in a truck.
Just to support your climbing.
What?
Just to support your climbing.
Yeah, well, it's you know, the way we live now, most people, you know, you need a lot of money for the things that we need, right? Your rent, your mortgage, your cell phone bill, your sushi, you know, tab. And, you know, back then I just basically needed gas and food. I was already getting a little bit of support with product from some gear companies. So, yeah, that and the once or twice a year plane ticket to go to Europe.
So I'm just trying to really understand. I mean, this totally took over your life. It pushed away the other ideas of careers, your communications degree, as I mentioned earlier. And you even walked away from your first marriage because of climbing.
Yeah. Yeah, that was probably to this day, the hardest thing I ever had to do.
Why did you have to do it?
Well, my husband was more, you know, he had a real job in Bend, Oregon, you know, wanted the house, wanted everything we always think we want, right? I even thought maybe at one point I wanted that. And, you know, I realized it was hard also because I, not wanting these conventions that I was kind of brought up, we were all brought up kind of knowing that that's what we wanted. I felt really alone in that and very strange and odd, and that was hard too, to feel so weird when it felt so right in my heart, you know. And
we were talking earlier about what a professional rock climber does, and you are not someone who participates in these competitions, which seems like it might have been a natural direction for you to go as your skill increased. Well, what was it about the competitions that didn't interest you?
It's funny you say that, because I was competitive, and I am really competitive. I was competitive in sports my whole life. And I think mostly the competition, the reason why I wasn't drawn to the competition part of climbing is that most competitions are held indoors on artificial walls and you know, or inside. And so much of 90% of the attraction to me with climbing was the being outside, the traveling, the different mediums that you climb on, the different kind of rock. So I think that's why I never was drawn to the competition part.
So your relationship with Patagonia began in 1999. Tell me how you make a living by interacting with that company.
Well, it's funny because the first clothing I ever bought was Patagonia clothing, and that was in Iowa City. And I knew nothing about, you know, outdoor gear. I picked up one of their catalogs, and I really, you know, their kind of business practices resounded with me. And so I thought, well, I'm going to buy these clothes. And I was always a fan of theirs. And I just, you know, the industry's, it's pretty small. And I was working at a trade show, and I was in their booth, you know, coveting all their clothes and admiring them. And one of the, just kind of the right person at the right time walked up and asked me what I, you know, if they could help me and what I was doing. And, you know, and they had used a picture of me from a photographer that was on a hang tag and sent me some clothes. And I said to him, I said, you know, I can't, it was a lot of clothes, and I thought it was very generous. And I said, you know, I'd like to do something in return for these clothes. And it kind of just started from there. And they were developing a new line with the specific to the type of climbing that I was doing, which is more rock climbing than alpine climbing. And so, you know, I was out there doing that. And, yeah, the rest was kind of history. And year by year it develops into more. You know, they support me in so many ways. You know, I do writing for them and tell stories on their blog. So it's cool that they find other stuff for me to do to support it. So.
And you travel the world now to climb. How much do you travel?
Oh, I'm probably away from, well, I know for sure I'm away because I tell my accountant every year. My domain, like more than 200 days a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how many countries have you visited this year?
This year, I think I've been, in the past 12 months, I've been in six countries. Yeah, six countries. Sicily, Spain, France, Ukraine, China, and Turkey.
Wow. And you also travel around the United States as well.
Yep.
And yep. One of the things you do is something called first ascents. What's a first ascent?
A first ascent is when you go up the rock face, and you establish a climb, a route that hasn't been done before. So essentially you're on terrain that no one's ever been on before or completed or gotten to the summit of. One cool thing we did in Venezuela, we got to the top of a tepuy that humans had never been on top of before. So it's pretty exciting. That's my favorite kind of climbing, actually, is the unknown and exploring new terrain. There's not, I mean, it's world's a big place, but people have been a lot of places on it, so it's exciting to be able to do that.
What's the first ascent that you did?
The first ascent, I think it was in Oman. We did this big rock face called Jebel Mish. It's like it's about as big as El Cap in Yosemite, and yeah, I think that was it.
There
were goats up there. It was interesting. You could see goat droppings. I'm like, how did goats get off here? There's these mythic tar goats that there's all these stories about.
So it sounds like maybe the goats could teach us all a few things about
yeah.
climbing. There are people who worry about the popularity of rock climbing. And, of course, it's clear that you enjoy these very wild places that you go. But there are people that worry that if rock climbers go to these places, then they could be damaged. Do you worry about that?
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, climbing is relatively low impact in that it's not a lot of fossil fuels involved in doing it, like a ski lift. But yeah, you know, and as climbers, I think we are all, for the most part, conscientious about that. I mean, that's why Yvonne Chouinard invented, you know, the kind of gear he did back in the day, because pitons were scarring the rock. So I think that is a possibility, but I do have a belief that as a group, we all are very conscientious about that and kind of keep each other in check.
After traveling all around the world several times and doing these first ascents and having so many experiences, what drives you now? What are you still shooting for?
Well, it's the same thing that's driven me from the very beginning. You know, climbing. It's not this thing I just kind of do on weekends or as this kind of, you know, extra activity. It's everything. You know, it's all encompassing. It's my health. You know, both physical and mental. You know, your brain stays sharp as well. There's a lot of focus and problem solving involved in climbing. It's my community, you know, the partnerships I have established and bonds I've made with my climbing partners are like none I've ever made in my life. And, you know, it's the whole lifestyle. It's really, you know, reassuring to realize that I can find all these essentials outside on a rock face. Sounds kind of simple and stupid, but it's true.
How long can you be a professional rock climber?
I think, you know, there are people in the industry for sure that are, you know, well into their 60s that are still, you know, you won't be able to climb at a certain level, you know, your whole life as you age, obviously. It's pretty physical. But, you know, you can stay involved at one level or another. And, you know, I think if you stay not just involved in the sport but within the community itself, you know, you have a certain stature in the community and experience and know kind of what, you know, people are needing and wanting. And
rock climbing is getting to be a more and more popular sport. Do you have advice for beginners?
Yeah, I think it's really easy to get into rock climbing now because of the presence of so many indoor climbing gyms. And, you know, you can get the skills there, how to tie the knots, how to belay, how the systems work, you know, just the kind of the physical part of it. And then, and, you know, some people, that's all they do, and that's great, you know. And then you can take, if you wish, you can take that outside and explore it further. But, yeah, I think it's important to get some sort of instruction, whether it's through a guide or a gym or a book, because it's not like, not to be too dramatic, but it's not like messing up a tennis swing or a golf swing. If you mess up your knot or your anchor, you know, there's fatal consequences, so that shouldn't be taken lightly either.
Well, and you do climbs regularly where you risk your life. Why is it worth that to you?
You know, it's a lot of the risk involved in climbing is inherent, right? Because you're dealing with gravity and exposure and weather and rock. But a lot of the accidents happen from human error, you know, just like you would air driving your car down the freeway and texting and, you know, getting a collision. So I guess it's just, to me, the risk is worth what I get from it.
Brittany, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Terry. Thank you.
Brittany Griffith is a professional rock climber. She works with Patagonia, and she travels the world. She's on the road or out in the wilderness 200 or so days every year. Talk of Iowa was produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, I'll talk with Larry Wogelmuth about his memoir, Larry Tells Stories, A Journey of Sexual Abuse, PTSD, and Recovery. This is Talk of Iowa.